All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started here, and I'll let you know right now. The first hour is the power hour, so any questions you've got about engines, maintenance, performance, troubleshooting, all that stuff. Second hour is general questions, and the calls are starting to come in pretty heavy right now, but questions are still a little light, so you've got a chance to get in. So if you've got a question for the first hour or the second, go ahead and press 1 on your phone as soon as possible. And if you press it right now, I promise I'll get to you. The longer you wait, the harder it is to get through. Let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Today is the Power Hour. This is the show where we take your calls and answer your questions about engines, performance, fuel mileage, upgrades, modifications, maintenance, troubleshooting, you name it. We'll tackle it here on the air. And joining me to help out, Bruce Mallinson, Leroy, and John, all from Pittsburgh Power. So we're going to welcome those guys back to the show, and we'll get to your calls here in a little bit. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Hey,
thank
Kevin.
You, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
It's always a pleasure.
Hey, before we get to anything you guys might want to start with, I had an interesting call the other day. Guy called me and he started talking about his truck. If I remember right, it was an 06 or an 07 ISX. Had just about 1,000,000 miles on it. And he was doing oil analysis. He had clean oil samples. He had good oil pressure. And the mechanic that he used told him, you really need to put a set of bearings in this because we just do it at 1,000,000 miles. The fleet that I work for, the shop that I work for, we just always did them at 1,000,000 miles. And he went ahead and did it, and 4,000 miles later threw a rod through the block.
Wow.
Yeah. So my response was, I think it was crazy to do the bearings in the first place. I looked at the oil samples, totally clean, you have good oil pressure. 1,000,000 miles on a set of bearings today is nothing. And he didn't know a lot about engines, so he, you know, the guy made it sound good. But his question was, could the bearing job have created the problem? And I said, I don't know if we'll be able to prove it, but absolutely, it certainly could have.
Yeah, that's a tough one there, Kevin.
I know it is a tough one.
I certainly don't like to badmouth or put down any other mechanics. So our stand is, if your oil analysis are good and you've done good maintenance, is just to leave the bearings until rebuild time. Sometimes people will pull the pan down, drop a main and a rod bearing, and look at them. Most of the time, they put them right back up. So bearing failure is kind of a thing of the past as far as wearing out prematurely. And back in the days of the 4 1/4 beat cat, it was 250,000 miles, but that's even gone now on that engine. So, our stand is you leave them.
Yeah, that was kind of what I said. You know, there are so many ways, if you're worried about bearings, to verify that they're okay. I mean, if you've got oil sample history, and he did, it wasn't just one oil sample, it was a history. Never any lead, certainly no copper. But, you know, worst case, pull it down and look at it. You know, I just thought it was kind of crazy. And now what do you do? I mean, could we... And here's the other thing. He had it parked at his shop. Now, this work didn't get done at his normal shop. Got done somewhere else. The truck was closer to his normal shop when it let loose, so he towed it there. And when he called me, he said, the other shop is coming over to get it today. And I said, here's what I would do. I said, I would pay your shop to take this apart and document everything. If there's some proof that, you know, maintenance that caused this, then you got a chance of possibly recovering. I said, but if the other shop takes it apart and figures out it was their fault, you may never know.
Well, and the other thing though, you always have to keep in mind, if a person would have left a rod bearing cap loose or a bolt, it usually doesn't get out of the parking lot, and it never pulls the first load completely. So being it did go 4,000 miles, I don't think the other shop made a mistake.
You know, and what I told him was, I said, I hate situations like this because it may be a complete coincidence, but you're always going to feel like, you know, did they do something wrong? I hate, it's such a bad situation for everybody.
I tell you, when you leave a nut loose or not really tight on an overhead or anything like that, it's usually within the first trip the failure happens, not 4,000 miles.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think his best bet is just to get a recon engine and put in it.
Yeah. Yeah, very sad. So what do you guys have this week?
Well, you know, last week we were changing the pistons on a PK, the Deck 4 Detroit factory rebuilt engine that just smoked profusely. Fuel mileage was 6.5 to 7. And we did make the piston change, and from the moment we started it up, white smoke was gone. The smell of raw fuel was gone. We also, this is the very first DDEC 4 to have a variable geometry turbo. And Leroy wrote a lot of the programs for it. And on the dyno, I texted you the specs there. We had 1,800 foot-pounds of torque at 1,200 RPM, and I think it was right at 600 horsepower and 28 pounds of boost. So now what we might have come up with here is we've lowered the torque, the peak torque, maybe another 200 RPM. So this engine may be able to run along now. It has three, still running at about 14.5, but it may be able to run a lot of level terrain and rolling hills at right at 1,200. Not sure yet.
Wow.
But first load, Pittsburgh back to Minnesota, he did right at, Leroy, was it 8.6 or 8.9?
It was 8.6.
8.6. So
with 78,000 pounds.
With 78,000 pounds. And plus, he said he's got to learn how to drive it now because it's totally different. When we were bobtailing it, we would put it in 13th gear at the bottom of a hill at 1,200 RPM and just roll into the throttle gently, and you'd watch the boost come on up, and it would just pick the truck right up and go. It was impressive.
Wow. Wow,
so
that's exciting.
Yeah, we're going to do a couple more and see what we get. Leroy, why don't you tell them about the on the VG turbos on a factory setting, what percentage it's closed and what you have it set at?
Typically, this is, when we say we put a variable geometry in a DDEC 4, they came that way with EGR. But in this case, we're putting on an engine that never came with EGR or a variable geometry turbo. So we had to make our own harness and everything to make this work. So typically at idle, they're set at 70% closed for back pressure for EGR, and his is set at 7%. So it's pretty much opened up that the engine can just breathe and there's hardly any back pressure on this engine. He goes along the flat at 65 miles an hour, like 2 pounds of boost.
Wow. That's awesome.
He just kind of rolls along. Yeah.
You could feel it when you drive it or ride it, and it just breathes freely. You just hardly hear the turbo at all. It's just moving along there at very, very low boost numbers. And he was able to do that with under load even. He was amazed at how little boost he was able to use.
But with the custom timing maps, we took advantage of leverage on the crank so we could use less fuel and just let the compression do the work, not so much the fuel. So that's why he's able to get away with lower boost.
We were
Wow.
Able to get to the 600 horsepower and 1,800 pound-feet of torque with only 2 degrees more pulse width than the factory 500 horse setting. Was it called for 32 and we were at 34 or something like that? Yeah.
And we did 600 at the wheels.
And when we put our usual 500 horsepower, when we used our normal 500 horse settings that we would normally put on an engine that we built, we dynoed it and it went to 656 horsepower and
like
2,000 pound feet of torque.
Yeah, it was just, I was like, oh.
It was big. It was really big. Like, wow.
So we just kept cutting fuel out of it still.
And the power didn't go away. We pulled fuel out of it and we didn't lose power. So we're getting a much more efficient burn with that flat boost curve. The ability for the thing to breathe without squeezing the exhaust through either a small housing or through a small opening in a VG turbo while it's at low RPM or when requested torque is low. Then when we look for torque, when it looks for power, we speed the turbo up to our liking. And then we keep that turbo speed even after the torque request is gone to help complete the burn on the fuel.
Yeah, you only need so much air, so you can just tell the turbo to keep lowering the boost until you meet the threshold for that. This is how much boost you need perfectly for how much fuel you need. So,
wow, that's exciting. A
lot of custom mapping.
Yeah, we've really been geeking out on this over here.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Hey, I've got to get to a break. We're going to come back and we're going to get to some of your calls and questions. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff on the Power Hour. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. Joining me today from Pittsburgh Power, we've got Bruce and Leroy and John, and we're going to get to some of your phone calls because they're starting to pile up. Let's head off to Washington. Bo, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Kevin. Jumping right into it, looking at the crankcase pressure, when you go and get a dyno, you give all these numbers here, and I don't really know how to read this. So what's a good crankcase pressure as opposed to a bad? More is bad, but you have the I sent you a PDF, and it's probably sitting in front of you. You want to look at that?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm trying to this is a different format that I'm used to looking at here.
Sure.
While I look at this, guys, why don't you just address the crankcase pressure in general?
Sure.
My feeling on crankcase pressure is if you do not have oil consumption, then we don't worry too much about crankcase pressure. Leroy, what are you normally seeing on the dyno?
It depends on the engine. What engine do you have?
It's a VED 12, the Volvo, so it's the one that you're not too well.
Yeah. You know. I would say typically, if I had to average out all the engines, I would say 3-4 inches.
Well,
is what I see.
The testing mm-hmm. methods vary. The Detroits we test at the oil fill cap with the breather pipe open.
That's true.
Cat's got a device that you put on that's got a controlled opening in it. Cummins has their own controlled opening. I'm sure that Volvo's got their own method as well. So with Cummins, I think 10 is the max, but they've almost got the engine sealed off, and you're pushing more of the crankcase pressure through the manometer to the pressure sensor if they're using a pressure sensor on the dyno.
Mm.
So you'd need to do a little more research to see what the specs are for that engine. You could probably simply Google that problem and find out. but they're all different. Right. They vary. Detroit's max is, I believe, 3 or 4. Cummins will be 10.
Right.
Cat something else. I'm not sure exactly what they all are. But there's a different testing method for each of them. And if they follow the procedure outlined in that manufacturer's manual, you're going to have different numbers and different max.
Well, and I have about 12,000 miles for a gallon of oil, so I don't think that I'm too excessively high. What I was trying to indicate is if this was actually an indication of something going wrong, you know, and sometimes that will reveal something, but I don't know. I guess I was.
Well, what was your
too hopeful?
I'm kind of with Bruce on this, that if it's a truck we're able to drive and see what the oil consumption is, I still think that's our best measure of, you know, where we are as far as how long we can go before an in-frame. When I do recommend a pressure test is if it's a truck you're looking to buy and we don't know what the oil consumption might be, then this might be an indicator for us. But I really like oil consumption better. But if I'm looking at a truck to buy, I'd like to have some information.
Kevin,
go ahead. Yeah, and that's what I ended up doing is I looking at the dipstick there, it was down about a gallon, and it was about 20,000 miles. And I know that's a little bit contradictory. I don't know. I didn't know if he added any at all, but I went ahead and did my measures, took it over to the Volvo dealer, and let him look through it and build up a list. And then I took it over to the Freightliner, you know, because they were the only ones that had the dyno in the area. So I took it over to them and it looked pretty good. I mean, I got the guys at the Freightliner there. They said, man, that thing must have a rebuild because that motor's in really good shape. Well, come to find out, it's never had a rebuild, you know, and maybe that information would have been a lot more helpful before I bought it. But really, I didn't spend a whole lot on the truck in the first place. And it's a really nice truck.
Right.
So, you know.
Good.
Anyway.
Yeah, you also have to keep in mind as horsepower goes up, flow by goes up. Back in the days when we were building 700 and 800 horsepower big cam Cummins, the big cam only used a half inch tube coming off one valve cover. And Mark Chappell, the performance Cummins engineer, said we need 3 breathers on those engines, the one on each valve cover. And if you look at a 3406E or a C15 Cat, I mean, my gosh, the tube's about 1 1/8 inch ID for the blow by. So it all depends on horsepower and the design of the engine. Oil consumption is the best way to go by.
I agree. Let's head off to Texas. Randy, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Bruce and Kevin. I've been one for Bruce here. Matter of fact, I'm sitting here looking at it, got the manifold off. I just re-rung my C16 and... I talked to Pete about it. He said, put an extra washer on them, though, but I still had. I replaced a couple of gaskets, but I got it all off now because I had a water pump leak due to the Evans didn't like that used water pump. So while I had it off, I pulled everything off, and he advised me not to use the stock-style tubes, but, boy, these other ones, those are actually the gaskets that come off the tubes, and they're awful big. I didn't know there was another gasket to try or just go ahead with the tubes.
No, we do not like those tubes that go inside the head. They do burn off in white box turbochargers. There's been a lot of Acer Caterpillar engines that had 2 turbos replaced because of those tubes failing. So the gasket that we use is fairly thick.
It's the same gasket. It's the same gasket off the. It's off the tubes. I had picked some up in Michigan, and I'm gonna have to find the part number and find some of those. They were, matter of fact, they were so much easier to replace without pulling the whole manifold off. You could loosen it up and slide them in there because they were half hole on each end. Now they gave me some other ones that the ring is really nice, but the holes don't match up, and the ring might be a little smaller than the diameter I need, but it's got a nice ring in it, you know. But, I'll go with them other ones,
We don't like the gasket that has the half a hole on the bottom because sometimes that pushes out a little bit during installation, especially up in number one cylinder. It's pretty hard to see, and a lot of mechanics aren't getting that lined up properly. So We prefer the gasket with the two full holes. That's the bolt holes we're talking about.
I had a hot belt once. Yeah, a rivet hole for the use with the flange there. I had a hard time with those lined up. I mean, when I took it off, I had replaced 5 and 6, and after I took it off, I noticed number 2 had been leaking. And I said double. I went and got all double washers for it, but I'm trying to figure out what else. I don't know what else to try there. They didn't work very good at all. They didn't last very long at all. I can't remember the torque. I know my torque wrench is still set at whatever it was because it was the last thing I torqued. So.
Make sure you run a straight edge over that manifold. We've had a couple that weren't machined exactly flat. Individual runner or each individual gasket surface was flat, but they weren't on the same plane exactly. I don't know if it was a mistake in machining or so forth, but we had one come through here, gone through two sets of gaskets pretty quickly, and we found that one of them was on a slight angle. So take a straight edge. And individually, just put it right on top of one of the ports on the manifold, and then see how that aligns with the port next to it. It should be flat parallel right on top of it. If there's an angle, you know it'll be higher than one on one side and lower on the other side, and you may have an issue with the manifold. So take a look at that manifold real close if you're going through gaskets prematurely.
Yeah, because they're all in pairs with the joints. So those joints flex somewhat.
Right. Well, check the one that's right next to it. So, in each pair. So, rather than put the straight edge across both of them, just put it right on top of one, and then slide the straight edge over toward the other side, and it should slide right on top of it. If you've got a gap, you may have an issue with the manifold.
Okay, I'll double check that. Bruce, did you get my pictures of the thermostats? Bruce,
don't know if I did or not.
I sent you an email. Well, 10,000 miles. I did them thermostats before we went back in and rerung it. Just 3,000 miles on them, I think I had on them. Then I still had, I put the turbo. I thought the turbo was leaking. We wound up with number one ring, oil ring was busted off. But we went through the motor and... You know, it running right up there, 200 degrees, 195, whatever, it's you're going to rely on the gauge needle, We're pretty close, pretty steady there when I first put them in because it wasn't warming up good before. And then after that, I started getting erratic between running 175. Sometimes it'd run 200, and sometimes it'd stay at 175 all day long, and it was plenty warm out, there was no – just tell me they were sticking. And I talked to one fella that he had talked to an older mechanic that swore up and down. He said, once you drain the water on those things, he says, or you take them out, you put them back in, he says, they won't work right again. They'll start sticking. And he says he's had that experience before where, if you had not very old thermostat and had that problem, and all I could figure was either surface tension or wear or corrosion. So I took mine and polished the heck out of them before I put them back in this time.
I've never experienced that problem, so I'm surprised at his statement there.
All right, I've got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more stuff right after this. Don't go away. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour, and we're going to get right back to your calls and questions. We're heading off this time to Georgia. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Good.
Can you hear me? Awesome. I have a 95 T600 with a 12.7 Detroit in it. And a few weeks ago, Kevin, you had a caller with a very similar tractor, and he was asking about rebuilding the thing from the ground up so you would have basically a new pre-emission truck. And one of the comments you made in your answer that I zeroed in on was you said once you had it torn down, you could pretty easily rebuild all the stuff on the bottom. Well, I kind of know what you're talking about, but I'm also pretty new to this. So what are those things on the bottom? I mean, I know airbags, et cetera, but, and what's the approximate cost to do this kind of rebuild from the tires up to the stacks?
Well, what I was talking about is some of the stuff that when a cab is still on is hard to get to. But if we're going to do a cab replacement, we can get to motor mounts and bushings and, you know, reconditioned frame. There's a lot of stuff in there that it's just easy to get to, much easier to replace if the cab's off. Cost-wise, boy, it could just be all over the board. I mean, it's not going to be cheap. I mean, if you're going to do this right, a cab replacement, my guess, we're going to be, you know, probably half the price of a new glider, which sounds really expensive for an old truck, but it's still half the price of a new glider. So I think it's an option for people who already own a truck, and I think it's an option to keep in mind if some of these legislative items go through that might eliminate gliders. I mean, the IRS is going after them again. The transportation bill is looking to outlaw gliders or make them be emission compliant. And if that's the case, they're just going to go away. So I was just thinking of other options. Bruce, what do you guys think of that? Anything else? Yeah. You know, once the cab's off, it seems like you just have access to a lot of stuff.
I can tell you when people do a body off the frame restoration, they spend between $50,000 and $80,000.
That's about what I was thinking. Yeah.
So if you're saying, wow, $80,000 in a 1995, but you make this 95 like brand new, what difference does it make what year it is? The beauty of a Kenworth and a Peterbilt and a Western Star, everything that's been put together on there, they can be taken apart. They're not built by robots so much.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, there are robots, but you can still take it apart. Everything can be replaced. I know people that have taken every rivet out of 359 Peterbilts and replaced every rivet. So you know, $80,000 invested in an older truck doesn't bother me if you make it perfect.
Like what I'm hearing. Well, thanks for the answers, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Buffalo. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today? Several shows ago, Bruce mentioned that they were going to get a tour of the PAC car factory, the engine factory, after the truck show. So I was wondering if that actually happened, and if so, if you could give us a brief synopsis of what you learned and when you think you might be working on those PAC car engines.
Well, I can tell you that I'm going to let John answer this one because it was John, Ethan, or Leroy and I there, and Debbie. So it was a good tour. They had one complaint, EPA. They have EPA problems. Isn't that amazing? But, John, you go ahead and tell them about the tour.
It was a pretty amazing tour. The first modern factory of that sort I'd been in, and in a previous life I'd got to tour a big factory in Europe. I actually worked there for about 2 weeks that built injector parts, and that was amazing. And this one here was even beyond that. The automation was unreal. The simplicity of how the process of putting the engine together, they've kept it very simple and straightforward. There's only one set of parts in each engine. We're coming up with all these variables for the Detroits, and what we found with the PACCAR was there's one set of pistons, there's one camshaft, that's it. So it's all quite simple. The different horsepower ratings are simply done with adjustments and programming and maybe a different set of injectors, and that's about it. But the plant itself was an amazing place. They employed how many people? 500?
Not very many. It was a lot. It's very automated.
Yeah, it's very automated, but they had quite a few people there. The campus itself was absolutely gorgeous. They've got their own hotel there. They've got is it 6 or 8 hotel rooms. And they're just absolutely beautiful.
The plant was so clean.
It was spotless.
Yeah.
They are still importing some parts. The castings are coming either from South America or Europe, some of them. I forget, what's the name of the type of material that casting?
CGI.
The CGI.
Compacted graphic.
Right. Evidently, there's not a plant here in the States yet that does the compact graphite castings like they like to use. It's a lighter, stronger material than your standard cast iron. So some pieces are coming over from there, and then the machining and assembly happens here. I think they're looking to build a plant, I believe, to do the castings here as well. But I'm very impressed with them. As for working on them, there is a program in place. PACCAR realizes that a lot of these engines and trucks are making it to secondhand market, and they don't want to force the secondhand owners into dealerships only with extremely high labor rates. So they're looking to set up 25 service centers, shall we say, throughout the country that are independent shops similar to ours. And now there's still some work to be done with that program. They've got more than an idea in place as to how they're going to implement it, and we'll be at the top of the list when it goes through.
Okay, that's good to know. Appreciate that.
All right. It won't be long. I'd like to think we'll be working on within the next year, if not the next 6 months.
Outstanding. Let's head off to Texas. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, Bruce, and everybody else. I was going to ask you a question about the variable turbo. I got a 12.7 Detroit, the 03 T600 Kenworth, 12.7 Detroit. Would that work on this engine or not?
Yeah, it would.
Yes. Go ahead, Leroy.
Yeah, that engine would... Let me back up here. I would like to put the 14-liter turbo off of the DDEC 5 on that engine. That is my preferred variable geometry turbo from Detroit. It's a little bit larger than the 12.7 variable geometry. But, yes, we would have to make a harness for it. But, it would work just fine on there.
And have y'all got is this like a kit? And do y'all have a price for this, whatever, with labor and all?
And labor and programming and dynoing and everything, we're thinking it's going to come out right around $6,200.
Oh, okay.
And if you gain a mile of a gallon, that's a pretty fast payback at $6,200.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I just had my engine rebuilt the first of the year, and they ended up putting 14 – they sent me 14-liter – engine kit for 12.7. The guy got it all put together, and they said it smoked the whole shop up when you crank it up. They found out they gave him the wrong kit. So I would have liked to have kept that in there, but they said it wouldn't work. But so it's running fine now. But I have bought some 150-gallon fuel tanks to go on my truck to upsize the fuel tank on my truck. Before I put these on there, is there an easy way to clean these things out? And if so, what's the best way to clean the tanks out?
John, that's your deal.
We've got a fellow who's in the pressure washing business nearby here who's built wands to get inside the tank, and he's also come up with some chemicals that seem to just dissolve the black coating, the asphalt inside of the tanks. If you could get them to us, we could get them to him, and he can do it. It's usually right around $500, which I feel is a bargain, especially after we tried for hours one day to clean a set out here with our power washer and gallons of bleach and every other chemical we could find. And with no luck, it was quite frustrating, actually.
His turned out really nice.
They come back perfect. Like I said, he does it all right through the openings that are in there already. He's got some chemicals that seem to eat right through that asphaltine, and really, they come out looking like new inside and out. So if there's any way you could get those to us, we could take care of that for you.
Yeah, I was going to try to do them myself, and I figured I'd be biting off one I could do. But I was thinking maybe getting some acid and just dilute it down and just put it in there and roll it around or whatever. But I don't know, would that be not so good idea?
Well, be careful with the type of acid you use. You may eat right through the aluminum if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. Hey, we've got to get to a break. We're going to come right back and get to some more of your calls and questions right after this. Don't go away. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up, everybody. We're heading into the final segment here. I'm going to try to get to as many of the Power Hour questions as we can. And then at the end, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff I say at the end of a show. But don't hang up. We're going to come back and do a second hour, and we'll get to any questions you want in that hour. So looks like we've got a lot of questions, but if you press one, you might be able to get through in the next hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Leroy and Bruce here helping me out today, and we're answering all of your calls. We're going to head off to Indiana for this one. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How you doing? I got an ECM question. Got a C1505 Acer. It's a BXS. What can you do on them ECMs?
The largest horsepower we typically do with those is like 550, 1850 of the wheels.
That's it.
1850 torque. That's 550 horsepower to the ground, correct?
Yeah, to the ground.
So, okay, so that's going to be a little more than what a normal, you know, you're, like when they say a 550, that's going to be a little more than what I have now, right?
Yeah, that's about 100 to 125.
Okay, all right. I'm around 5.5 miles a gallon. I think my 90-day average is 5.6. Is it going to get a little better than that, you think? Because I was going to send it in last week, but since you guys are out there, they wanted to wait till you guys got back out east there to send it in. So, but I was wanting to send it in as soon as I could. I just didn't know how much better with you guys getting in there everything would be.
Leroy?
The fuel mileage.
Yeah, typically the I've seen results. What do we typically see on BXSs? I'm trying to think of a good number that we saw on mileage.
6.5 is about.
I'd say 6.5.
6.7.
Pretty average here for those.
Yeah.
You say you're only getting
okay.
5 now. I would say it should go up probably to 6, depending on what you drive, what you carry.
Yeah.
You know, different conditions.
I'm either,
obviously vary.
Either 80,000 or I'm empty, one or the other. So
yeah.
Do you have the fast fuel system on there?
No, that's about the only thing I haven't put on. I did single turbo it, which about the only thing that done was made the right side of the motor look better. didn't really gain much. But I've got it done, so I'll just leave it like it is. But I didn't know if that would have, if you have to do anything different on the ECM for that or not.
No, it has no feedback to know whether it has one turbo or two.
Okay.
So you don't have to do
all
anything.
Right.
So what
I will
about
gain
the,
a little.
Did you
little
change
more
the mufflers?
Straight. I got straight
okay
all the way through, so I don't have
okay
any mufflers.
Okay.
And I've got, you know, the fleet air filters and everything. It's a lot better.
Okay.
When I first got it, it was around 4.6. So I've gained quite a bit. But I'm trying to get just a little more power. Is it the BXS or is it the EPA that you can't do anything with to make that?
No, I think it's limitations in the ECM for the BXS.
Okay.
Hey, Roy, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think there's more to be gained from it as far as power goes, but that's a bit of some extensive research and stuff like that. So typically what we use is like 550, 1850 to the ground. So that's what we, you know, we tried and true, we know works. So we also want to make it reliable. We don't want to, you know, harm the
energy
by adding more power than we need. So.
Right. Okay. Well, and then I'll just probably put the power box on it eventually and go from there then.
That's what I would
Cats
do.
Cats respond
it.
Very well.
Just all
right,
that,
we are... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. With the single turbo, though, you almost need the power box.
Got it. We are going to head off to Montana. Joe, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, guys.
What's on your mind?
Can you hear me, Bruce? Or
yes.
Kevin?
Yes.
Yeah, hey, Bruce, you know me. Talked to you about my DDEC 6 before. And, you had given me phone numbers for a couple of guys that have a DDEC 5. They really like the way you tune their DDEC 5, but I have a DDEC 6 with a barrel geometry turbo.
Right.
You're talking about putting that on a 12.7. What do you think this you can do with this DDEC 6? And it's right now, I mean, I'm not very happy with the performance and the fuel mileage. I was wondering if you could make that actual better. But, I mean, it's not the DDEC 5, which the other day you know, I talked to the guys with the DDEC 5s. They're a complete different engine, aren't they?
Yes, they are. There's a lot of difference. And we do have some programs for there and some things. Can you bring the truck to the shop?
Well, you know, I might be able to do that in a month.
Okay, well, that's about when we could get you in because we have the CMC coming up, and then we have some we're going to be doing emissions testing for the week. Well, we're going to get caught up then the week after, and then the following week, right after Memorial Day, we're going to spend a week doing emissions testing on different products. And then that following week. So it would be like the second week of June when we could do something for you on that. And, yes, we could get you more performance and more reliability and better fuel mileage.
Okay, well, the question is, would I have to get a different manifold? Because one thing, see, this engine right now, it doesn't have the power in the lower RPMs. But when my RPMs go up to like 1,600, then I got decent power, I didn't get no fuel mileage.
We can bring that in much sooner. That's all in the programming of the ECM and the variable geometry turbo. We can fix that for you.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yeah. If we can get a 12.7 to put 1,800 foot-pound of torque out at 1,200 RPM, we can do that on your 14-liter.
Yeah, okay, well, that sounds good. So I would also gain fuel mileage, I imagine, too, right?
Absolutely. Performance properly driven always equates to fuel mileage.
Yeah.
You've got to drive by the boost gauge or the Kevin scan gauge. You've got to drive by one of those two gauges, but you're probably doing that now.
Yeah, well, I drive like Kevin drives, 57, and I don't make no fuel mileage. But the problem is... I don't have no power in these lower RPMs.
Yeah,
we have one or the other.
That's my problem.
Yeah, that's a pretty easy fix there. So make an appointment for about
good.
A month from now, and let's get it fixed.
Okay. The only thing is, I won't know till like 5 days in advance when I will get there. So can I do that with like 5 days in advance then?
5 days will work.
Yeah, in a month from now. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good, Bruce.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's see if we can squeeze another one here. Let's go to Washington. Jim, welcome to the program. Jim, are you with us? Jim? Going once?
No Jim.
No Jim. Sounds like somebody's there. Well, guys, we don't really have, I think by the time I get to another call, we're going to end up rushing it. I was just looking at something here that I wanted to mention anyway, so I'm going to take a little time. I was just reading an article about a truck. The company's called Nikola, N-I-K-O-L-A, which if anybody is familiar with the Tesla, which is wildly popular and very well built and expensive. Tesla's the electric car, probably the best electric car on the planet. Nikola was the first name of Tesla, so this electric truck company is kind of playing off the Tesla name. I can't find a lot of details about it, but they're claiming that it's going to run some sort of a natural gas turbine on top of six electric motors and making 2,000 horsepower and all kinds of torque. And yeah, it's kind of crazy. But here's the thing. One of the details I could find about it, it's looking like you can reserve one right now, which I'm almost trying to find out if this thing's a hoax. They're claiming 2,000 horsepower and 3,700 foot-pounds of torque with a 1,200-mile range. Guys, does that sound like it's even possible with today's technology?
John's been doing a lot of research on this, and we are getting ready to build one, Kevin. So go ahead, John.
I firmly believe it. That's where that seems to be a takeoff of right speeds. I'm actually looking at it. You mentioned it as I searched it on my phone while you're talking. It is definitely plausible. If they've got everything together to do it.
$375,000. That's
probably
maybe
what
we'll,
it would cost.
Okay, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that next week when we've got some time to dig into that a little deeper. It looks interesting. Thanks for joining me. This was the Power Hour. We'll see you next time. Thanks to the guys there at Pittsburgh Power, as always, for helping us out. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy, and always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, hang on. We're going to start another hour of general questions. Anything goes. Let me check the call volume right now. I think if you were to press 1 on your phone right now, we've got a lot of calls on the line, but not a lot of questions. So if you were to press 1 on your phone right now, we might be able to get to you, but don't wait too long. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it. We'll tackle it here on the show. All you have to do, pick up the phone and give me a call. And I'll tell you what, these weeknight hours go by so fast, we're just going to jump right into the phone calls tonight. We're going to start off in Indiana. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, I had a couple of questions, destination health questions. Recently found out that my girlfriend was prescribed statins, and my father has been taking them for years. He's 76 and former airborne ranger. You know, he could take me out anytime he wants to still. And
yeah.
Basically, I've been talking to him about the keto diet and what I've been working on. And I remember you talking about the dangers of statins, and I couldn't really remember too much about it because I don't take them. So I didn't recall the information, but I did mention to them what you've been talking about, how low cholesterol is basically a path to dementia and Alzheimer's. And, you know, that's the last thing I want for anyone in my family. So could you just go over that information again about the dangers of statins? And I'll be sure to let them know about it.
Yeah, I'm probably going to do a whole show about this because there is so much to cover, and the drug industry is pushing statins hard. They have even attempted to get statins over-the-counter status so more people could take them without even a prescription. Here's some of the biggest reasons why you just shouldn't take them. I don't care if you have high cholesterol or not. High cholesterol isn't the problem we thought it was. You have to dig deeper than that. But here's one of the reasons. They just don't work. They do lower cholesterol. There's no question about that. That's pretty well documented. But it's kind of like when I talk about fuel mileage. The goal isn't to get the highest fuel mileage we can possibly get. If it was, I would go build a very, very light truck. We might do a carbon fiber frame. We'd end up with a $500,000 truck, but it would get the best fuel economy possible. Well, we don't do that because that's not the goal. The goal is to save the most money possible. It's kind of like this. The goal isn't to get your cholesterol lower. The goal is not to have a heart attack and live longer. So if that's the criteria we use, statins don't work. Every single study that's ever been done, people on statins have just as many heart attacks or more, and they don't live any longer. Most of them live less. And they have lots of other problems. Muscle pain, very, very common. Memory loss, very common. There's an excellent book called Lipitor, Thief of Memory. I highly recommend that book for anybody who's taking statins. Another good book on this topic is Cholesterol Clarity, which is also written by Jimmy Moore, who's going to be speaking at the CMC. He wrote Keto Clarity as well. So they don't work. They reduce CoQ10. And CoQ10 is incredibly important to our health, even though a lot of people don't even know what it is. Most doctors now have figured out that if you put somebody on statins, you also supplement with CoQ10 because it is such a problem. The problem I see there is I'm not a big fan of supplements. Many, many times trying to supplement a nutrient never works the way it does when we get that nutrient either from our food or from our body, and our body produces CoQ10. The problem is statins block that production. So then we somehow think that, well, we can just take another pill to replace the CoQ10. I think that's a horrible idea. Statins also reduce vitamin K2, another not often talked about vitamin. You know, if you look at the Price-Pottinger research, they believed that K2, they actually called it the X factor of certain foods, primarily organ meats and eggs, because they were so healthy, and people who had high diets high in organ meats and eggs had all kinds of health benefits, but they couldn't figure out what it was, so they called it the X factor. Well, it turns out it's vitamin K2, and statins reduce K2. Statins also reduce ketone production. If you are trying to get into ketosis and all its benefits, you're going to have a tough time if you're on statins. There's an overall increased risk of serious diseases, probably because we're blocking CoQ10 and K2. Cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative diseases, musculoskeletal disorders, cataracts, I mean, the list goes on and on. And we're doing this all with no benefits in the end. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, she had no idea about the CoQ10. I take it as a supplement ever since seeing Dr. Andrew Weissman. He had said that's one of the most beneficial supplements to take these days. So I've been taking 100 milligrams a day, and the doctor didn't even inform her or the pharmacy about taking that as well. So that concerned me for sure. But
that to me is criminal. This is very, very well documented that if you are going to put somebody on statins, you should be supplementing with CoQ10 NK2. My thought is, why ever take the statin in the first place? Because, you know, if you want to take CoQ10 as a supplement, probably a good idea. I would still try really hard to get a healthy diet so our body produces enough of it. But if you want to try for a little extra, no harm. But I certainly don't want to take a drug that's going to block my body from producing it in the first place.
Oh, yeah, I can definitely understand that. Well, that's great information. I sure do appreciate it. I'll be sure to let them know. I'll record the show. They can listen to it. And also, I had questions about potato starch. I went ahead and got some after, of course, reading or listening to Dr. Hyman's book, Eat Fat, Get Thin. I also bought Keto Clarity by Jimmy Moore. That was a great listen as well. Just bought Eat the Yolks on Audible. And basically, I got the potato starch like Dr. Mark recommends. And do you use that? And what are some ideas to put it in? Because I tried coffee. I turned my coffee into basically a gel. So I just ate a tablespoon of it or a teaspoon of it, and it was not pleasant.
No, it's not. So you don't want to put it in anything hot because it does two things. It'll thicken up, and it will become non-resistant starch. The whole point of potato starch is that it's what's called resistant starch. Our body can't digest it, so it feeds our good gut bacteria. But if you heat it up, then our body can digest it. Now it's like a cooked potato, so you don't want to put any heat to it. I'll tell you what I did with it. I kind of created a little tonic. I drink about 8 ounces every day of this. It's probably not for everybody, but you may be able to play around with this. I actually like it. I take 8 ounces of water. I put in about a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, raw apple cider vinegar, about a teaspoon or two of the potato starch, and then a local raw organic honey. So the honey kind of mellows out the apple cider vinegar, and all of it kind of hides that raw potato taste. And okay, I'll make an 8 or 10 ounce glass of that, and I'll just sip on it. And actually, it's one of those things, when you first taste it, it's a little odd, but it's one of those things kind of like the beet kvass. The more I drink it, I actually start to crave it.
Okay, great. Well, I'll definitely check that as well. And before I ask my last question, I just wanted to say thanks again for all you're doing with this. Man, I feel about 20 years younger, and I love the way I'm eating, being able to eat, you know, satisfying foods. I don't just think about food when I get to a destination like I used to. I used to get to Memphis and love to get some Memphis fried chicken. Don't even think about it anymore. You know, in a long 500-mile run, sometimes my right ankle would swell up. That's completely gone. And it's just made such an improvement in my life. So keep up the good work. And one more question I have was about the MCT oil I picked up. What are some uses for that besides the Bulletproof coffee? What do you personally use it in?
It makes great salad dressing.
So you use it instead of olive oil?
Yeah, instead of any oil. It's virtually tasteless, so your salad dressings, when you make it, will all the other flavors will come through. So, and, you know, making salad dressing is drop-dead easy once you learn how. I mean, it's oil, vinegar, and seasoning. And you use a stick blender. I like to throw a raw egg into my salad dressings because it makes them really rich and creamy. But instead of using like an olive oil, you use the MCT oil. It's virtually flavorless, and you get the MCT, which is outstanding. So there's the music. I've got to get to a break. We're going to come right back with more stuff. Kevin Rutherford. welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Texas. Leo, welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to find out, you should have an oil sample there. It's the very first oil sample I pulled out from this truck that I already purchased. It's a glider from Schneider.
Okay.
I don't have much information of what kind of oil or anything like that, but what does that look like as far as an oil sample goes?
Do we have any idea how many miles might have been on the oil when it was taken?
No idea. No idea whatsoever.
Okay, so I'm going to guess, and this is only a guess, that it was in there a while, and I'm guessing that because we've got some oxidation. And oxidation can happen over time. That's one of the ways we get oxidation. But the other way is if we have a lot of blow-by. I'm not seeing any other evidence of a lot of blow-by, so I'm going to assume this oil's been in here a while. The iron is up around 40. That, to me, means there could be 25 or 30,000 miles on this oil. And if that's the case, this looks really good. I mean, we have a tiny, tiny bit of fuel dilution, but nothing I would worry about. Soot is a little high. That's not a big deal. Usually getting soot under control is fairly simple. We would look at things like possibly a dirty air filter. So I would put a Fleet air filter in it. May or may not have some exhaust restrictions, so I would put a Pittsburgh power muffler in. Both those things are really cheap. And I would do an overhead on it because that's another real possible reason why we get soot. No wear metals, nothing else going on. So, for a truck coming off of a fleet, this is a great-looking oil sample, and my guess is with a little bit of tuning and upgrades, we can make it look even better.
Okay, yeah, I've almost put 10,000 miles in the truck already. I'm at about 2,000 miles away from it. I was thinking of changing the oil. Should I even bother taking another oil? Should I bother taking another sample? No, just wait until afterwards?
I wouldn't. Yeah, the problem with taking another sample is we don't know the mileage. You know, and that's the problem with this one. I can look at it, but I can't make, real detailed recommendations because I don't know the mileage on the oil, and that's important. So let's just change the oil. Get a fresh start, do your first oil sample at 25,000, and then we'll go from there.
Should I, is it all right for me to go to the synthetic, or should I just run regular oil once again and take it from there?
So far, you said you put about 8,000 miles on it. Have you had to add any oil yet, or is it down on the stick?
It's not down at all, or have I added anything to it?
Okay, then I would switch to synthetic. Should do just fine.
Okay. I got another question. On your scan gauge, I've been playing around with that boost and how it reacts. And I'm noticing that anytime that the Jake brake kicks in, if I'm going down a hill or anytime I use the Jake brake at all, that boost kicks up. Does that mean that I'm actually burning, wasting fuel at that point or not?
No, this is a really good question, though, because we always talk about boost pressure equals fuel consumption, and the more boost you have, the more fuel you're consuming, but this is the exception. The only way the Jake brake can come on is if your foot is completely off the throttle, and once your foot is completely off the throttle, there's no fuel going into the cylinder at all, zero. What's happening, though, is what the Jake brake does is opens the exhaust valves to release the compression. That's what causes the braking power. So when the exhaust valves open and we release the compression, it's spinning up the turbo, but there's no fuel involved.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. The other the other question here. Sometimes that idle, it's idling really nice, but then I'll get all of a sudden it'll get a little bit of a shake, and it'll shake there for not even 30, 40 seconds, and then it goes back to normal. And then the other thing I've noticed is if I take my foot off the throttle abruptly, it kind of reacts like it wants to turn the Jake brake on, but my Jake brake is off at the time. But all that mean it's part of the overhead that I should do an overhead on it?
I would do an overhead. It may or may not fix that rough idle that you're talking about. The Series 60 is kind of known for that. I've had a bunch of them do it, and sometimes something will fix it, and many times it won't. So I don't get too worried about it. I would replace the crankshaft damper and put a balancer on it. That'll smooth it out some, and I would do the overhead, and that may help. But I've had Series 60s that did this almost their whole life, so I don't get too worried about it. It's pretty common. Let's head off to Maryland. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
See, I tried to get in during a power hour, but I got held up at a shipper. I'm going to have Pittsburgh Power look at my ECM at the CMC next coming week. I guess I'm first on the list. At least I'm first at something. But
oh, good.
My question to you is, my situation, I got a 2001 6NZ. I got $1.1 million on a rebuild. I'm only using about a gallon of oil every 6,000 miles. My oil samples are coming back fantastic. I just had an overhead done, and I put new injectors in, and it seemed to be running better than ever. I'd like to get a little bit more out of it. Now, they've got two different ways they could do my ECM over there. One is reprogram the whole thing, which is considerably more than just giving me a little more torque and a little more horsepower. What do you think?
You know, that engine responds really well to two things, to their full-blown programming or the power box. I've driven them, and it really puts a smile on your face. So,
well, here's my thing is the thing is going to need an end frame probably within a year or a year and a half. Would it be, I mean, a wise investment to reprogram that computer now? And would I have to redo it again after a rebuild?
No, I'm assuming that when you do the end frame, you're still going to keep this truck.
Absolutely.
Oh, then absolutely do it now, because it won't need touched when you do the in-frame. Nothing will change.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Another question would be, would I be compromising the longevity of this in-frame that I'm on right now by messing with that? Or just the opposite, would I be benefiting?
The answer to that is just like the answer to fuel economy. When we turn up horsepower, the result always depends on the connection between your brain and your right foot. If you will use the additional horsepower and torque, you will lose fuel economy and you will lose engine life. If you use it properly, you will gain fuel mileage and gain engine life. So, it can actually be beneficial.
Okay. Well, good. That's the information I was looking for. I think that has made up my mind then. I think I'll just have them do the full-blown program on it.
There you go.
Now I replaced a sensor for my pyrometer a second time in 2 years, and it just went out again last week on me. So I think I got a problem somewhere else. Would that behoove me to have that taken care of, too, before that?
I would ask them. They may know. I don't know if – you know, it's very possible – you know, we do have parts just fail, and then we replace them and they fail again. It always makes us start to wonder, is something else going on? But I don't know of anything that would cause that, but they might. So since they're going to be looking at the truck anyway, I would ask them that and see what they think. Let's go to Columbus. JR, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing, brother?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Hey, my old hand cooks, my drive tires on my tractor are about ready to be replaced. I can't wear the damn things out, so I've been running them. They're getting down almost nothing, and I want to get them done before June. Is it worth the bang in the buck right now in the Michelin Advantage program to go to Super Singles, or do they have some new developments coming in where I can just replace these 8 tires with something that's almost as fuel efficient? What route would you go?
Yeah, let the music's playing, so that's a great question, and some things have changed over the last year or so, so let's come back and we'll talk about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phones. I was talking with JR in Columbus. So, JR, you know, the wide single has been promoted pretty heavily as you know.
Right.
Just because a tire is a wide single doesn't mean it's more fuel efficient. There are lots of wide singles on the market that are less fuel efficient than some duals on the market. So the number always comes down to rolling resistance. That's the only way we know. Now, having said that, Michelin's wide single is really the most fuel-efficient tire for a drive position. But right now, with fuel prices the way they are, it's hard to make an argument to switch to wide singles just for fuel economy. There's a pretty
right.
good payback period there. There are some really fuel-efficient dual tires that would be more cost-effective right now. Now, fuel could go back up to $4 a gallon next month. It could go higher. Who knows? But I look at the whole picture, and I really like wide singles. I like the handling, and I've really had the opportunity out at Michelin's Proving Grounds to – do some crazy things with trucks. And the way we did it was they would set up a truck and run it with wide singles and then set it up identical. The only change would be to duals, and they would be Michelin's best dual tire. It wasn't like we were comparing it against some junk tire. But we would take it out on the wet track. We did high-speed lane changes with 80,000 pounds. We put trucks into power slides. And I was blown away by the handling on the wide singles, better in every single test. So that was impressive for me to see that. I love the fact that it's so much easier to check my tire pressure. I'm not always screwing around with that inside tire. So they're lighter, they handle better, they're easier to maintain, they're easier to check your pressure, they do get better fuel economy. So when I look at the big picture, I'm kind of a freak about tires. I'm willing to spend a little extra on the wide single for all the advantages. And if fuel comes back, then there's a huge upside to having the very lowest rolling resistance we can get. But if the only consideration is fuel, there's some tires on the market that if fuel is, you know, $2.50 a gallon or less, actually make a little more sense.
What tires would you be talking about, like something like that? I've always been partial to Michelin, and I understand what you're saying about the Super Singles, and I would like to try them. And like I said, I've got to call Mission and Advantage and see if they've got a strong deal like they had last year when I didn't need tires. So,
right.
You know, I've got the TPMS system on all my tires, so it's not really, you know, I don't have to check my tire pressure that often. It's just, I'm just wondering which way should I go.
So if I didn't run duals, I would have the new X line energy, the new steer tire they just came out with. I would I would have that in all 10 positions. And prior to having duals, that's what I did for years. I had the XZA1 in all positions, and then when the XZA3 came out, I switched to that, and I ran it in all positions, and I love that combination. Even in the winter, even in really bad weather, in most cases, that tire will outperform a lug in bad conditions.
Wow, okay. Yeah,
the
I just put some X lines on the front. Now, what's the rolling resistance on those X lines? I haven't been able to find that.
You know, I don't know if they've come out with it now since they brought out the newest version of it, but it's always been right around 100. That tire,
right.
You know, the XZA1 was 100. In fact, that's the base tire they measure everything else against. The XZA3 mm-hmm. was always around 102, 101. Every year it would change a little bit. My guess is it's definitely under 105. And so, you know, it's still a great tire as far as rolling resistance, and there are so many advantages to having it all the way around. It's quiet, handles really well, they last a long time. If you start to get an unusual wear pattern on a steer tire and you don't catch it in time, all you have to do is solve the problem, then rotate that tire back to a drive and bring one of your drive tires forward. In fact, one of the things I used to do was put that tire all the way around, run it 50,000 miles, and then rotate the steers back to the drive and two of the drives up to the steers, and then the steer tires would wear like iron. When you wear that tire in on a drive axle, then put it up on the front axle, it does really well.
Oh, wow, okay. All right. Well, I'm also looking at the bang for the buck, so like I said, I'll have to talk to Michelin Advantage because the two X lines I put on the front of mine on that program, I think was right around $1,260 for both. So we're looking at almost, you know, $4,800 to $5,000 to put them all the way around. So I'll have to call and see what the Super Singles, if they got a program going where I can put those on, and I'll make my decision there.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, Like I said, it's one of those areas where I don't really try to save a lot of money. I will spend money on tires, and I've been very, very happy with that. You know, I was just talking just yesterday. I put two new steer tires on my coach, and I've got an 18,000-pound front axle on this. It carries a lot of weight. So I went with the XZA2 Energy in a 315/80, and that was a pricey tire, about $750 a piece. Although I saved $100 a piece with the Michelin Advantage program, but I'm really looking at the idea again of building that four axle combination, and using this tire would really we could build a four axle and trailer combination that would be able to grow 78,000 pounds, but would be significantly lighter than a five-axle combination that can only gross 80, and we would be able to payload more on four axles than most people can do on five. So I'm kind of interested in that idea again. Let's go to Louisiana. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What can I help you with today?
Well, I changed my compressor last week, and apparently the mechanic pumped used engine oil in with my antifreeze back into my engine. Now I'm having to deal with trying to get it out. Is there what kind of problems can I look forward to?
Oh, boy. So are they going to take care of this for you?
Well, I've done a couple flushes with washing machine detergent and water, and I'm on my way back up there now, and they're going to give me new antifreeze. But I, you know, what else do I need to do?
That's about it. I mean, I actually like to use dishwashing liquid like Dawn or something like that. That's really good at cutting grease, and flush it through, and then follow with clean water. And that's really about it. You just have to flush it till you get a good, clean flush coming out the other side. But other than that, that should be all you have to do.
Okay, yeah, it really panicked me when I seen that. Oh, man, here goes my engine. But
no,
okay.
Well, here's the thing. Even if that oil stayed in there, it's not really going to hurt the engine. The coolant, I mean, it could cause some problems long term. I mean, all we want in our cooling system is good coolant water. But remember, the coolant really isn't touching components. It's only flowing around the outside of stuff in you know, hoses and jackets. And so even if you have a contaminant, it doesn't really cause short-term damage. Now, it could hamper the cooling effectiveness, but then you would know it. Your engine would get hotter. It could start to cause some deposits and some sludge in places. But it's not one of those things that just because it got in there, something's going to be damaged. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. You caught it quickly. You're going to get it cleaned up. You'll be fine.
Okay. One quick question. I got an exhaust leak, an N14 Cummins, by the way. The back section at that seam is leaking. I'm looking at finding a used manifold or another manifold for it. How bad is that hurting me?
There's the music. Let me get to a break and I will come back and address that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, quick heads up here. You may be able to squeeze in one more call if somebody presses one here. We've got one more segment. Calls might be able to squeeze one more in. So if you press one real quick, I might get to you. Or I might not, but here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'll finish up that call on the exhaust leak. You know, the number one rule of a turbocharged engine is we just don't want any exhaust leaks. But again, it's almost kind of like the oil in the coolant. It's not one of those things that causes any kind of immediate damage. It's something we want to get taken care of, but it's not something we need to miss a run over. But schedule it as soon as you can and get it taken care of. And make sure the shop does it right. They check all the mating surfaces, all that stuff, so we don't end up with the same problem again. Let's go to Scott. It's your turn. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I got a question about a truck I just found the other day. It's a 2000 Sterling. I don't know what your thoughts and feelings are about those. They seem to go by the wayside and became more of a vocational truck over the years. Is that correct? Or
It is, and I never owned a Sterling, but I owned a Ford the year before Freightliner took it over. And, well, it was right around that time it changed the Sterling, then Freightliner took it over. But it was still basically a Ford. I mean, nothing really changed. Here's one of the
things.
You know,
they're
actually, it was kind of the – it's solid in the sense that I didn't have any real problems. I had very low cost of ownership on that truck. What it wasn't was comfortable. It feels – it reminds me of an old Mac where they weren't very quiet. When you close the door, it sounds like all you hear is metal against metal. It doesn't have that, you know, kind of luxurious feel of, say, a PACCAR product or even a new Cascadia or a Volvo. It was very vocational, kind of. You know, there was nothing soft or quiet or, you know, they were. It was very noisy inside. I can remember talking on the cell phone in that truck was really difficult. It was loud. And like I said, just not a very comfortable truck, but the one I had, I bought brand new, kept it to 1.3 million miles and had a very, very low cost of ownership.
This truck's got 1.1 on it and needs an overhaul according to the website I found it on. They want $6,700 for it. So I don't know if that would be worthwhile for a starter truck and rebuild the motor the way I want it done or.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you're not, and I don't want to make it sound like it's horrible. It's not. You know, I had a team in mind, and they didn't really complain all that much. They were just fine in it. We did that for over a million miles with a team in it. So, yeah, this is a great starter truck at that price. Have you talked to anybody about why they're saying it needs an in-frame?
No, I have not called them. This place is known for saying that and then not having those problems, so I'm assuming they might be right, they might be wrong. I haven't really spoke to them. I used to deal with them in the past when the company I worked for bought new trucks, and they were terrible to deal with then, so if I get it off them,
okay.
Just figure it out on my own, you know.
Yeah, the reason I ask is with an N14, 1.1 million miles is nothing. They very commonly go to 1.5, and I know two of them right now that have 2 million miles on them and haven't been touched yet.
Oh, okay. So it might not need an overhaul. It just might be something that they missed. So.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases I was talking on the last Power Hour about, you know, our best indication of when an engine needs an in-frame is oil consumption. But if we're looking at a used truck and we have no way to know what the oil consumption is, we can do a compression test, a crankcase pressure test, to see how much blow-by there is, and that would give us an indication if it needs an in-frame or not. Or, like I said, they may have some other reason for that, but I would check. You may pick up a $7,000 truck that you don't have to touch for a couple of years.
Okay. One more quick question is, it's a high top. Now, putting that in a flatbed operation, is that a terrible loss? I mean, being that truck so cheap,
it's not. It's, you know, we always try to match the profile of the tractor to the profile of the load or the trailer, but it's a little thing. And you're doing it the way that doesn't hurt as much. We don't want a flat top pulling a van. We don't really want a high top pulling a flatbed, but if I had to pick, I'd much rather go with that. There's less of a fuel economy drop doing that. And again, for a $7,000 truck, if we lost a half mile per gallon, which you're not going to, I would still do it. Because, I mean, that's just a great way to get started with an inexpensive truck like that.
Yeah, that's what I figure. If I put, you know, $20,000 into the truck over whatever time, even just in the motor, you got $25,000, pay it off in a year, 2 years at the most, and you're making money with the truck. So, all right, that's
exactly
all I got for you, Kevin. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Arizona. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing good. What's on your mind?
Okay. I just got a cab over with a Cat Engine 99. It's a car hauler. And we just got a ticket for carbs in California. And we are thinking to install a DPF filter on this one. And
okay.
I was wondering if the P2 Power, did they start installing and or not yet? Because
they haven't installed one yet. They're still talking to the company, and I wish I had a date, but they're waiting on somebody else. So it could be very soon. I know John's working on it pretty hard.
So not yet.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, so no hard dates yet, but hopefully something soon. Hey, how much was the ticket?
It was $1,000, the first one.
What did they say the next one would be?
They didn't say.
Okay.
So we don't know, but we don't want to know.
Right.
Yes. Actually, the DOT with somebody from the cars, they stopped us on I-10 just after the scale. And they checked the trucks. The truck is 99 with a Cat engine. And, you know, they write a ticket.
Yeah, interesting.
So,
I haven't heard of too many of them. That's why I wanted to ask just to see. You know, honestly, I'd hate to have to pay a $1,000 ticket, but for now, I would probably take my chances in California till I got the first one. But we'll keep working on that DPF filter. Tuesday afternoons is always when we record the Power Hour with Pittsburgh Power, so that will be the most likely place we'll get an update, so stay tuned for that. Let's go to Indiana. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I've been listening to you for the last 10 years, man, and I agree just with everything you said. But here, I value your opinion. I know what you think about the new trucks with emission things in them. But, man, I have Volvo, 2008 Volvo. I got almost 980,000 miles on it, and I'm thinking of getting a new truck. I have a chance that dealership offers me 2015 Western Star 4900 EX with DD16 600 horses with 342 rears.
Don't do it.
Okay.
Don't do it.
Okay.
For two reasons. Don't buy a new emission truck. You may have gotten really lucky with yours, but this is one of those things. Sometimes you'll hear me answer a question and I'll say, well, you could kind of go this way or you could go this way. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
There's no wrong answer. This is not one of those questions. This is probably the one thing that I am most adamant about. I will not buy an emission engine. I'm just not going to do it. There's too many ways not to right now. Secondly, almost every 16-liter engine we've ever dealt with turns out to be a problem. The Volvo 16-liter was a nightmare. I'm not a big fan of the DD16. I don't see the point. The DD15 produces plenty of power and torque. I would not go with the 16-liter engine. The one exception was the 16-liter Cat. It's not necessary, though. I mean, that was a good engine, but I just don't see the need to have a 16-liter engine. They use more fuel. They're heavier. They're more expensive. So why not think about having that same Western Star built as a glider? They make that one available.
That would be my next question. I hear the music coming, man. Should we keep talking?
No, we're going to have to cut this one loose, and maybe we'll get you back on to talk about it again. But I would look into building that same Western Star as a glider. I'm all out of time. These weeknight hours fly by so fast. So many questions, so little time, but we'll do it again. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always.
do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
All right, everybody, thanks. Tomorrow we will be continuing on with the NTP series and then doing general and destination health questions in the second hour. So we'll see you then. Thanks.